After months of negotiations, the two sides recently agreed on the rules of engagement. But there is no progress on the comprehensive ceasefire, as Taliban have linked the truce with peace deal. But the Pakistan's foreign minister, who also met the Taliban leaders, said Taliban have shown their readiness to seek an end to the war. Afghan Taliban and the US signed a landmark deal in February this year. The deal outlines a roadmap for the US troops' withdrawal from Afghanistan. In return, Taliban agreed not to allow Afghan soil to be used again by terrorist groups. Given Pakistan's historic ties with the Taliban, the US and Afghan government expect Islamabad to ensure that the Taliban live up to their commitment. At the moment, all eyes are on the incoming US president as to whether he will follow the same policy on Afghanistan or take a different course.
On paper, there seems no change in the policy of US President-elect Joe Biden with regard to Afghanistan. But he may not hasten the troops' withdrawal as sought by President Trump. This means the situation in Afghanistan will remain uncertain, at least in the foreseeable future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
In recent years, the U.S. Federal Reserve has reported multiple times that 40% of Americans don't have the cash to cover just a $400 emergency. Then COVID hit. The lack of savings is now almost twice as bad. A recent poll by the Highland Consultancy reveals that a stunning 82% of Americans now don't have the savings for a $500 emergency. It's a shocking reminder that the wealth in the richest nation in the world is distributed in a shockingly unequal fashion. For the average American household, $500 is equal to half a month's housing costs, 3 weeks of transportation, 2 weeks of childcare for one child, and less than a month of food.
If human needs are met, then people can put money away for emergencies. But when you're living where you can barely feed yourself, and where you can barely meet your housing needs, how can you possibly put money away?
In the decentralized United States, uneven, often draconian lockdowns are entering their ninth month, but there hasn't been any government help since a federal package in March. The result is a bevy of simply atrocious data, which reveals the financial suffering of the average American. 63% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck since the pandemic began. Public sector wages recently had their biggest monthly drop ever. New weekly jobless claims were greater than the worst week of the Great Recession for the 39th straight week. 800 small businesses have closed every day nationwide since April. Clearly, America's Main Street was already teetering on the edge prior to Corona.
We've got a society that's structured towards not meeting basic needs. That's important to everybody in the economy, that it have a sound foundation. And if you have people who are desperate on your foundation, the economy is always in danger of collapsing.
Corona deaths keep rising, the economy keeps plummeting, except for rich assets like stocks, and it's still not certain who won the presidential election. The U.S. is in the middle of its worst crisis since the 1930s, but it might be even worse than that. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said his country will no longer be affected dramatically by U.S. sanctions. He also accused the U.S. of imposing sanctions on Turkey to prevent it from becoming independent and developing its own defense sector. Erdogan's comments came after U.S. imposed sanctions on Turkey's defense industries and its chief.
This decision is a blatant assault on our nation's sovereign rights. This has been imposed for the first time against us, a NATO member. What kind of an alliance is this? Now we will work twice as hard to make our defense industry fully independent.
Turkey has always criticized the U.S. for its unilateral actions against other countries in the region, such as Iran.
This is not the first time that the U.S. imposes unnecessary sanctions on other countries. The sanctions come as a punitive act against any country trying to become independent. But I think that Turkey will overcome the sanctions.
Washington had already punished Ankara in July by barring it from developing parts for and acquiring America's next generation F-35 fighter jets. Earlier, Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif condemned what he called U.S. addiction to sanctions and contempt for international law. The sanctions cut off Turkey's top defense procurement agency from U.S. financial institutions, military hardware, and technology. Ties between the two NATO allies, Turkey and the U.S., were strained last year due to Ankara's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia. However, Turkey says it had to resort to Moscow to meet its needs after its own allies stopped responding to its demands. Reshan Saglam, Istanbul.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has stressed that the Islamic Republic will certainly take revenge for the U.S. assassination of the country's top general, Qasem Soleimani. Ayatollah Khamenei said Soleimani, who was killed in a U.S. drone strike in Iraq in January, has turned into a national hero for Iranians as well as Muslims elsewhere in the world. The leader said million-strong funerals that were held for the general served as a severe slap in the face of the Americans. He added that the expulsion of U.S. troops from the region will be a more severe blow to the United States. Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader called on officials to explore ways to remove sanctions, but stressed that efforts should be focused on neutralizing the sanctions first. Ayatollah Khamenei cautioned against trusting the enemies and warned that America's hostilities towards Iran will not end even after President Donald Trump leaves office. The leader also lashed out at the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal, saying they have showed utmost breach of commitments and hypocrisy. Also, President Hassan Rouhani said Iran is not overexcited that Joe Biden will replace Donald Trump in a matter of weeks.
Some people say you are rejoiced at the election of Mr. Biden. No, we are not, but we are very happy that Trump is leaving. A man who committed so many crimes, who was a murderer, a terrorist, a man who even is preventing us from buying coronavirus vaccines. This man has absolutely no morals. Yes, we are very happy that this tyrant, the one who was not committed to anything, is ousted.
Iranian officials have time and time again stressed that it does not matter who takes the helm at the White House as long as U.S. hostile policies towards Iran remain in place. Still, all eyes are now on the next U.S. administration to find out whether it will toe the line of its predecessors or reverse the course.
The Gaza Strip is witnessing a sharp increase in coronavirus infections, with thousands of cases being discovered on a daily basis. The Gaza Strip has logged more than 30,000 COVID-19 infections, mostly since late August. Hospitals in the blockaded enclave are running short on intensive care units to treat coronavirus patients. Experts say the Israeli blockade imposed on Gaza is the main reason why tackling the deadly pandemic is particularly difficult.
The blockade had devastated the Gaza Strip even before the coronavirus pandemic. Now our health sector suffers from acute shortage of medicines and hospital supplies. The health sector is falling apart, and the world must immediately intervene and help the Gaza Strip fight the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the tiny enclave, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
The health sector has been under pressure because of the blockade, and the coronavirus pandemic has only made things even worse. Over 200 people in Gaza have already died because of coronavirus.
The Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medical equipment, despite the alarming number of coronavirus infections.
We demand an immediate end to Israeli violations that amount to war crimes. We also hold Israel accountable for its illegal actions. Medicines and hospital supplies must be allowed to enter Gaza to help fight this deadly virus. The main obstacle to fight the coronavirus pandemic in Gaza is the Israeli blockade.
The United Nations has warned that the enclave's health system could collapse if the number of cases continues to rise. Gaza's health system has been battered by the Israeli blockade and three wars since 2007. The dire situation has worsened amid the coronavirus pandemic. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
An exhibition called Beyond the Columns of Media opened at the Museum of Classical Art based in Rome's La Sapienza University. The initiative, sponsored by the Italian ambassador to Tehran, Giuseppe Perrone, is the result of collaboration between the Italian Archaeological Mission in Iran and the Ministry of Cultural Heritage, Tourism and Handicrafts of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran's ambassador Hamid Bayat and La Sapienza University rector Antonella Polimeni were among the attendees of the event.
We decided to focus on the Kermanshah province from two points of view. One is that of sustainable tourism, and the other one, the study of cultural heritage. What we did here is travel the road that goes from Kasr Shirin to Kangavar and crosses ancient media.
The exhibit features 16 panels put together by Italian students representing an ideal journey through the great ancient trade route and communication network known as the Silk Road.
It's very important because all these informations help us to understand better how the Sasanian period work, how the region were connected.
Panels portrayed the historical region of the media between the Mesopotamian plain and the Iranian plateau. The exhibition itinerary follows a diachronic development that starts from the Iron Age through the dynasties of the Achaemenids, Arsacids, and Sassanids.
Italy and Iran have long-standing connections that go back in history and have resulted in a deep understanding between the two countries. The cultural and political relations date back to the time of the Roman and Persian empires and are marked by important affinities.
This project represents the full potential of collaboration between Italy's and Iran's cultural institutions. Its implementation makes us once again rediscover long-established Italian-Iranian connections.
Due to the COVID pandemic, most academic activities have been carried out remotely via video conference. All attendees wished for a prompt return to pre-COVID ways of working. Max Civili, Rome.
Britain woke up to more worrying news this December morning. 19,000 fewer workers out of paid employment in November than at the start of the health crisis, meaning coronavirus continues to weigh heavily on the UK labor market.
Is this the direct impact of the pandemic on the UK's labor market?
The problem started before the coronavirus, and the measures being taken are only glossing over the realities. The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs.
Released by the Office for National Statistics, the report also says there has been a record rise in redundancies in the 3 months to October, 370,000 of them. Worst hit, those in the hospitality sector, teetering during the pandemic. The government says its measures are necessary for beating the virus.
We've put a lot of work in over the past month. There's been enormous sacrifice on everyone's part, and we want to make sure that we continue suppressing the virus. The good news is that we've made improvements, whether it's in mass testing or early promising news on vaccines.
While the prospect of a functioning vaccine has injected some optimism into people's lives, experts say the next few months are likely to remain very challenging.
Do you think more people are going to be out of work in the coming months?
Yes. They will falsify the figures. And they do that by, they've done this for years and years. And they massage out of the figures people who are really unemployed.
Add to the mix the immediate impact of a no-deal Brexit, the UK leaving the European Union without a trade deal at the end of this month.
There's also the fact that the unemployment figures don't tell the whole story. There's always a lag in the data. And the government's job retention scheme, also known as the furlough scheme, is propping up the labor market. For now.
In November, the UK Chancellor warned the number of unemployed people in the country was expected to surge to 2.6 million by the middle of next year. And that may be a conservative figure. The fact is that COVID-19 is here to stay, and it'll be months, if not longer, for everyone to be vaccinated. The unforgiving equation is that the tighter the measures to protect lives, the more devastating the impact on livelihoods. Saeed Pariza, London.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on October 12, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participants at the joint graduation ceremony held at the Imam Ali Military Academy.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and Prophet, and upon his pure household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. Greetings be upon Hussein, upon Ali ibn al-Hussein, upon the children of Hussein, and upon the companions of Hussein. First of all, I wish to congratulate you, dear brave, experienced, and young graduates in our Armed Forces Academies, and also the arrival of young cadets in military academies to prepare themselves for passing through these glorious stages. Moreover, I would like to thank the Chief of the General Staff of the Armed Forces and the commanders in the Armed Force Academies for their brief and beneficial statements and reports. I also thank the Master of Ceremony for his eloquent speech. The organization of this ceremony at the same time and in the same place, during which all Armed Forces Academies gather together, contains a good piece of news: the emergence of an opportunity of the Armed Forces Academies to get close to one another, to benefit from each other's experiences, and to cooperate with and to help one another.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Their relationship is certainly to their benefit, and this ceremony has been organized in the illustrious Imam Ali alayhi salam Military Academy. I cannot forget that in the year 1359 in the Iranian calendar, in the beginning of the imposed war, a number of students from this academy went to the front, to Ahwaz and Susangerd, and engaged in fighting. They were still students, but they began their endeavor while they were still students. My dear ones, one of the things that gives value to an endeavor is the goal behind it. If we want to evaluate things, we should see what goals exist behind them. If this idea is correct, which is certainly correct, then studying in military academies and in armed forces organizations is one of the loftiest and most valuable endeavors. Why? It is so because by studying these universities, our youth enter the armed forces with the purpose of ensuring the security of the country, and security is a noble and fundamental value for the country.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Kitty, good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hoped for nothing but bounty, and from whom I feared nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
That debate.
At the start of the 1960s, the UK embarked on a program of covert action in Latin America. While the work of U.S. intelligence in the region has been widely publicized, the U.K. role is much less known, but recently declassified files reveal attempts to influence elections and disrupt trade unions in a number of Latin American countries. At the behest of the British Foreign Office and MI6, a decision was taken in London in 1961 to increase covert activities where the role of Britain was kept hidden, with a particular focus on black propaganda, which involves false material and being deliberately misleading about who is producing it. With the British historically known for meddling in countries like Iran, India, Palestine, and so on, what was the actual extent of their interference in Latin America? Well, let's start off this segment with our correspondent, Amina Taylor, who's with us from the British capital, London. Amina, why hasn't this story been covered by mainstream media?
But from places from Ecuador, Cuba, Chile, when you have statements where there's a little gold star attached to Venezuela, where it says, oh, a very rich target, very good because of its resources, it shows where Britain's concerns were. It was about influence, that extending that sphere of influence, running alongside Americans, essentially picking up any of the diplomatic scraps that were left there and building its own, but about establishing its own kind of dual power base where it could, if things didn't go well, as if it didn't in some of the cases, you could easily shift the blame to Washington and say, well, look at those guys, you know, Britain's been far more sneaky in its endeavors, and I think this recently released cache of documents shows that it's not really a surprise to those who are watching this historically. And goodness knows what the next 50 years or so will bring, because if, touch wood, I'm alive to look at those new documents that will surely be revealed about the extent of British influence in the region now, I think so many of us will realize we've just skimmed the very surface, by it.
All right, thanks a lot. That was our London correspondent, Amina Taylor. Let's bring in Mr. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, who's with us from San Francisco. Mr. Becker, welcome to the program. Why do you think the UK carried out these operations in Latin America?
Well, I think that we must remember that for a century and a half, Britain was the dominant empire in the world. And its empire included, although it was really a prelude to a widespread neocolonialism. The relationship to much of Latin America was a neocolonial relationship in that it didn't involve widespread conquering of territory. There was British Honduras, now Belize, and British Guyana, now Guyana, and the Falkland Islands, they called them the Malvinas, the Argentinians do. But it was more an economically dominant relationship of extreme exploitation of many countries. Venezuela, the gold mines of Venezuela, and gold and Venezuela have come back into the news this year. The relationship with Argentina, which was really in many ways kind of the breadbasket of England for beef and for wheat and so forth. So there's that long-term relationship. 100 years ago or 120 years ago, half of all the foreign investment in Latin America was British foreign investment. It's not nothing like that now. It's really more like 1% or 2% of the foreign investment. But Britain is looking to restore a much stronger position in Latin America, and particularly as Brexit approaches. And that would be, particularly in regard to food, food imports into England. I think the bottom line is this, is that Britain was once the dominant foreign power in Latin America. It no longer is anything close to that. The British, as your correspondent said, have always been willing to take the scraps off the table as the junior partner of U.S. imperialism, whether it was in Iran or it's in Iraq, or in Afghanistan, or in Libya. You know, the British government has, since World War II, with lots of contradictions, which I don't want to underestimate in any way, but has been the junior partner of the U.S., a faithful servant. And, you know, back in the early days of the Iraq War, there were the depictions of the British Prime Minister as the lapdog, and that was certainly an appropriate depiction.
Latin America expert Isaac Biggio joins us now, also from the British capital, London. Mr. Biggio, welcome to Press TV's debate. This would appear puzzling to many. The UK at that point was overstretched. Latin America fell outside its area of strategic interest, and UK covert action was in fact dwarfed by that of the US. Why the effort then?
Well, you have to understand that the UK was the main power that created Latin America, because the UK supported the independence movements against Spain. 5,000 UK troops supported Simon Bolivar. Then the UK was the dominant power, the dominant foreign power in Latin America for more than one century. It was involved in the war between Chile, Peru, and Bolivia, in the two Paraguayan wars, and defending the unity of Brazil when it has some secession movements in the 1820s. So it had a dominant power, and the pound was the main currency in Latin America until the First World War. So Britain was perhaps the main power until the Second World War. So it lost its hegemony toward the United States, but it always tried to keep some influence. And as we saw in this document of the 1960s, the UK tried to overthrow the Cuban government to stop Allende taking power in 64, was against an Ecuadorian nationalist government. The UK was working with the United States, albeit the UK never restored its dominant position in Latin America.
Mr. Becker, based on the files declassified in 2019 and 2020, the UK reportedly worked on trade unions through infiltrating and capturing them or disrupting meetings. We can see that the level of interference was widespread. Why was this information not disclosed sooner? Why now?
Well, of course, the governments of the United States and Britain, France, Germany, they all want to keep their what they're really doing hidden. They want to be able to pretend, oh, we're the forces for democracy in the world against the forces of evil and all that. And so to expose the fact that they're really intervening in this heinous ways in the people's movements in Latin America and around the world, meaning trade unions in particular, which have a particular importance and particular power, and in governments and political parties. This is, you know, very widespread, but as I say, exposing that to the public view really puts a dent in the idea that these are really democratic countries and that they're interested in upholding democracy. You know, they all were fine with the brutal, murderous, indescribable dictatorships in Latin America that came into being, starting in Brazil in 64, and then, you know, in Chile and Argentina and Uruguay and all over the continent, just about. These really brutal regimes, they were fine with, they were supported by Washington and by London and by their other allies. So this, I think that explains the fact that the mass media, the corporate mass media in both countries, really, when push comes to shove, acts as a voice of the government, acts as another branch of the government, in fact. And it has to be investigative reporting that's done to dig through, you know, the all the material and find the truth of what's been going on and expose it to the world.
Isaac Biggio, in 1961, London decided to increase the covert activities where the role of Britain was kept hidden, with a particular focus on black propaganda, where people are deliberately misled about who is producing it. Talking about corporate mass media, which Mr. Becker just mentioned right now, the BBC has allegedly been complicit in such actions. That wasn't just in Latin America, was it? We have Iran, we have India, and other countries coming to mind immediately.
Yeah, well, the BBC has never been neutral, no? But why this year is so important, because this is the year in which Cuba decided to become a socialist country. It became close to the Soviet Union. It was the first time that the Soviet Union have an important ally in the Americas. And so the UK and the United States were very much afraid that the Cuban revolution could be expanded. So they tried to stop government like the one, the left-wing governments like the one in Brazil. They tried to combat nationalist movement, to fight against nationalist movements in the continent. And, well, as you know, London has always a policy to defend their own interest in the war, no? In the Middle East, in Africa. London used to be the most important overseas empire in world history. So after the Second World War, the UK gradually lost its empire, but it tried to keep some influence with the Commonwealth and working together with the United States with a special relation. In the case of Latin America, a very important issue that united London and Washington was to stop Moscow in Cuba and to stop the spread of the Cuban Revolution.
Sure, Mr. Becker. The operations included creating a new magazine in Colombia, distributing pamphlets in Chile and Bolivia. Local radio producers were bribed to get airtime and produce tapes to be played. Doesn't that bear the hallmarks of the British colonial meddling in the Middle East, the Indian subcontinent, and elsewhere?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it wasn't just Britain, but even on a much greater scale, the United States did the same. There's a very interesting book that came out several years ago called The Cultural Cold War, about there was a vast plan that included tours of dance companies and theater companies and the production of books and pamphlets and movies and videos and everything you can imagine. By the U.S. and the British on a smaller scale, but still significant scale, to try to delude public opinion in different parts of the world in their favor. And, you know, I have to say this, that back in 1895, when the U.S. and Britain almost went to war over Venezuela, and they settled it, but the British got to keep their gold mines, which was their big priority in Venezuela. Now, today, in July of this year, the British High Court ruled that the Britain did not have to turn over a billion dollars in gold bullion that's in the Bank of England account to Venezuela, saying that Guaido, Juan Guaido, this imposter, this really, you know, a figure who will be remembered, I think, as a comedy in history, that his government was the legitimate one, even though he hadn't run for president, that he was the legitimate president. And this, again, following in the footsteps of the United States, following and promoting the U.S. policy as well. But there we have 125-year link between of gold in the relationship of England, of Britain, to Latin America. It's the same thing continues in just different forms.
Right, and Mr. Bijo, as you mentioned earlier, this was in the 60s, but when we look at the dispute, for example, with the Malvinas Islands and the war that took place in 1982, the colonial attitude towards Latin America wasn't confined to just one certain period, was it?
Well, the United Kingdom always tried to have ambitions in the Americas. There are several countries in the Americas that accept Elizabeth II as their queen, Belize, Jamaica. There are many Commonwealth countries, Guyana, for example. And Britain tried to create colonies in what is now Argentina, you know, they tried to Buenos Aires. And finally, I think in 1839, in the 1830s, they took what the Argentina called Malvinas and what they called them the Falklands. And in this war, it was very important for Thatcher, as you can see in this film for the royal family, you know, the crown, that Thatcher used the Malvinas Falkland War to consolidate her power. Without that war, she would have been removed from power because it was quite unpopular. And it was the first and only time that we had a war inside the Antarctic area, because part of the war were in Georgia and the Sandwich Islands. So the UK has always tried to keep their influence in the Americas, albeit now is not so important. And allow me to talk about something about Guaido, because the other person talk about that. We had just in Venezuela on the 12th of December, Guaido organized a referendum. When the Catalans did a referendum, they were not allowed to do that. There were more than 1,000 people arrested, and the European Union supported Spain. When Guaido organized a referendum, that there was no repression on that referendum. Until now, nobody knows what are the results. Everybody could vote. People can vote 3, 4, 5 times. People can vote even forging their documents. There's no international control, and despite all of that, Guaido is being recognized as the president of Venezuela, and the USA said that this is a legitimate election. The one that Trump lost in the United States is not a legitimate election, but this one it is. So this is the kind of democracy which the main powers are promoting. doesn't matter what is the opinion of the population, it's their interest. And they are supporting Guaido. It's incredible. They are still supporting Guaido and recognizing him as a president. Any president in America without any, without control of their own country.
That's a very interesting point you brought up there, Richard Becker. I'd like you to comment on that as well. What similarities can be drawn to what is happening today, for example, with Venezuela or Syria, for that matter?
Well, I think that it's very clear that what's happening to Venezuela, there's a true disaster going on in Venezuela, that the cutting off of virtually all trade is a terrible, and it's reminiscent of what was done to Iran back in the early 1950s, when Mossadegh was the elected head of government. And we see this also in Syria. And what do we see in all these countries? We see hungry people, people who don't have medical supplies, because these sanctions, as they're called, these what are really amount to international blockades, are imposed, and Britain participates fully in it. The U.S. leads the way, but it's a disaster for the people of all those countries. And these sanctions should really be declared as crimes against humanity. They're nothing less.
All right, gentlemen, let's leave it there. Allow me to thank my guests, Mr. Isaac Biggio, joining us from the British capital, London. He's a Latin America expert. Also thanks to Mr. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition, speaking to us from San Francisco. Also a special thanks to you all for staying with us on Debate. It's goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
On the same day the first American received a coronavirus vaccine, the U.S. pandemic death toll surpassed 300,000 on Monday, December 14th, another grim milestone that comes less than 4 weeks after the number of COVID-19 deaths in the country reached 250,000. Despite constituting just over 4% of the global population, the United States of America is home to nearly 19% of more than 1.6 million COVID-19 deaths that have occurred worldwide. The disproportionate impact of the pandemic on the American population was called a catastrophic failure of leadership to be blamed on President Donald Trump, who baselessly claimed in February that the virus was on the verge of disappearing. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "It Never Had to Be Like This. 300,000 dead in U.S. from COVID-19 under Donald J. Trump." Here is the details of this article. On the same day the first American received the coronavirus vaccine, the U.S. pandemic death toll surpassed 300,000 on Monday, December 14th, another grim milestone that comes less than 4 weeks after the number of COVID-19 deaths in the country reached 250,000. The Associated Press put the staggering statistics into context. The number of dead rivals the population of St. Louis or Pittsburgh. It is equivalent to repeating a tragedy on the scale of Hurricane Katrina every day for 5 1-second months. It is more than 5 times the number of Americans killed in the Vietnam War. It is equal to 9/11 attack every day for more than 100 days. At the same time, Brian Walter, who lost his 80-year-old father to the disease, told NPR that the numbers do not reflect that these were people. Everyone lost was a father or a mother. They had kids. They had family. They left people behind. According to the COVID-19 tracking project, the U.S. is now averaging nearly 2,430 deaths per day. Jennifer Nazo, a public health researcher at Johns Hopkins University, told AP that to think now we can just absorb in our country 3,000 deaths a day as though it were just business as usual, it just represents a moral failing. Despite constituting just over 4% of the global population, the United States of America is home to nearly 19% of more than 1.6 million COVID-19 deaths that have occurred worldwide. The disproportionate impact of the pandemic on the American population was called a catastrophic failure of leadership to be blamed on President Donald Trump, who baselessly claimed in February that the virus was on the verge of disappearing. There is no need for that many to have died, David Hayes Bautista, a professor of medicine at the University of California, Los Angeles, told the New York Times. We chose as a country to take our foot off the gas pedal. We chose to, and that's the tragedy. As Common Dreams reported earlier this month, progressives have argued that the catastrophic handling of the coronavirus crisis in the U.S., while made worse by Trump and non-cooperative individuals, is better understood as the product of several decades of free market ideology and associated policies that exacerbated inequalities and hampered an effective governmental response to the disaster as it unfolded. Although Monday, December 14th, coronavirus vaccine rollout represents good news in the fight against the pandemic, physician and public health experts Ashia Jahar Brown University lamented that the worst is yet to come in the United States of America regarding the coronavirus pandemic. as a result of infections that have already happened or will this week. We will pass 400,000 deaths in January, he said. He also added that vaccines will help, but if we are serious about meeting the challenge of preventing the COVID-19 death toll from reaching 500,000, we can and must do more to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Actions taken collectively can really change the course of what is happening, Nicholas Reich, a biostatistician at the University of Massachusetts, told The Times. He added, one reason this is hard to predict is, to some extent, the power is in our hands.
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.